This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. The International is an annual Dota 2's eSports tournament and is one of the most anticipated eSports events of the year. Today, we'll explore this growing area of sport and take a look at some of the legal and ethical issues that are currently prevalent in this industry. Joining me on the show today to tell me more about that is Richard Wee, who is a sports lawyer, and paralegal Brian Wu. Welcome to the show, Brian and Richard.
Hey, hi, Kelly. Nice to be back.
So before we go any deeper into the topic for our show today, let's start with the basics. You know, what qualifies as eSport?
I'm going to try and take a jab there despite being the older guy here. A good question, Kelly. Actually, that is a common question we face even though we are merely the solicitors doing work on eSports. But from what we can see internationally, worldwide, globally, any game, any computer game which has evolved into a competitive nature between 2% or more has now become an esports.
Mm.
You know, yeah. So that's how I think. I wouldn't say the word. How do you define or how do you decide what is esports? I would describe to you what esports is.
Mm. And last year, 10 million ringgit was allocated specifically for esports in the tabling of our budget. And now, esports will also be featured as a medal sport at the 2019 Southeast Asian Games. So it's clearly gaining some traction. So can you paint me a picture on how prevalent this industry is here in Malaysia and globally?
Well, I think I'm going to ask Brian to also take a jab on that, but let me give you a slight overview first. You're spot on about the budget. The government of Malaysia have granted 10 million ringgit to MDAC to kickstart the esports industry in Malaysia.
Mm.
And the acknowledgement of the SEA Games is a very, very essential, I would say, a big milestone for esports in Malaysia. So across the board, the atmosphere and the ecosystem of esports now. So with regards to the ecosystem in Malaysia, because of the government involvement, the government support, it has become more and more prevalent among the Malaysians all over the age group. You know, there is a perception that esports are played by the youth. That's incorrect. There are many fairly adult players, someone who was 40 over years old, male or female. They are actually getting involved in certain esports too.
Right.
And now with the potential professional capacity, professional career in esports and tournament for esports, more and more people are getting into it. So it's a growing group. Maybe Brian may want to, 23 years old ladies. Mm. Yeah.
Brian, do you have anything to add on to that?
I think also because this is the fourth industrial revolution, so technology is growing, is taking over a lot of aspects of our lives, and because of this accessibility also is the other issue that I think, or the other benefit, because it's so, pick up a mobile phone, you can play an esports game. So there is this, always this thought that, hey, I could be the next big thing in esports. And Malaysia has some of the best players in Dota 2 way back in the past few years. We have, even today, one of the best player who is going to play at the international next soon. He is also Malaysian. We have 5 Malaysians in that event. So it's we always have this notion that we may be the next big thing.
Mm. And Esports Malaysia, or ESM, is the governing body for electronic sports in Malaysia. So last year, the Youth and Sports Minister, Syed Saddiq Syed Abdul Rahman, said that the restructuring of ESM will take place in March this year. And, you know, that would be when the association holds its election. Well, it's August now. Well, you know, what are the updates on that front?
Well, I can share some information which we were recently informed of, and we both Brian and I, we have some personal engagement with ESM. ESM recently held an AGM, I think about a month or 2 months ago, and they have elected a new president. And I understand that the new committee have already taken steps to rename ESM to Esports Federation of Malaysia. That same new committee have taken steps to get the esports team to be selected for the SEA Games, the selection process, coaching. They are also now trying to change the way they communicate and engage with the esports community. I understand they've even appointed a communication officer to deal with communications with the community. Most of them are new in the new ESM, or also known as Esports Federation, which I think will be formally announced very, very soon.
Okay.
And in fact, today, at MDAC, they had a press conference announcing the new Level Up conference in 2019. I think it's the fourth Level Up conference. So the new process is going to be that this conference will be open to the public instead of the usual register and come in. And at that press conference, MDAC and ESM, now they formally, in fact, they just announced that they are going to be known as ESF, Esports Federation soon, signed a memorandum of understanding towards building a esports project together. So there are things going on, and I think what the Minister YB Sadiq has mentioned way back earlier in the year has to some extent or large extent taken place. Of course, unfortunately, both Brian and I, we are not privy to the what exactly is happening in ESM. But from what I can see, I think the new committee taking over ESM is genuinely trying to change, evolve, and hopefully become more acceptable to the esports community.
And how effective has ESM been in tackling issues in esports in the past?
Oh.
Either one of you want to take this?
All right, I'll take the question. All right. I think those ESM committee members who prior to this, if they hear what I'm going to say, some of them may not be happy. But I'll just say it. That there were events involving tournaments where players were not paid, events co-organized with ESM. Some were actually organized by ESM. Of course, we will never know what exactly happened. Was it ESM's error? Was it the sponsor's error? We're not privy to that information. But all we know is that players are not paid. And these are players who won, legitimately took part in the tournament, declared as winner, runners-up, etc., but they didn't get paid or never received their prize money. That's what I meant by it, not get paid.
Right.
So until now, they have not received. So that's quite bad, if you ask me. As in any professional setup for sports, the key is to pay your players. So in the past, that was one of the biggest challenges faced by ESM, and I think that was what why YB Sadiq had to say what he said, which you just quoted, because of that perception that ESM may not have done enough. But I'm not sure whether the new committee can deal with those questions and challenges, which was, I think, happened about 3-4 years ago. And legally speaking, if anybody want to take an action against ESM, they have about 6 years to take the action within limitation period, and it's still within 6 years. So I'm not sure whether any party who wants to take action against ESM have waived their rights, etc., etc. I'm not sure. But that, if you're talking about the past, that's the past, one of the main issues, and still haunting ESM until now.
I see. Brian, you yourself are a casual esports player.
Yeah.
So when we talk about some of these reforms that ESM has planned, what kind of changes are you expecting to see in regards to that?
Of course, one of the main things is better player protection. We esports players work so hard. If you read about their daily lives, they spend hours and hours just not only playing a game. I think this is a misconception that people generally have, that people just play the game of 8-10 hours a day. But actually, a lot of their time goes into researching. So reading, like, what are the different changes in the game, watching, re-watching my match again and again, what could we have done better, researching on opponents. So it's a lot of time spent in that side of things. So with so much work and effort being put inside, the last thing we want is, or last thing esports players want is, to not get the prize money, not get paid your salary. And I think this is a very prevalent issue in esports. Very recently, even the top tier players have released statements of non-payment of wages. And it's something that I think the scene has to grapple with in order to move forward. And ESM being the governing body in Malaysia, I think this is one area which they can put their foot down and do something about it.
Besides some of the things that you just mentioned, such as better player protection, you know, what are some of the other major legal issues currently facing the esports industry?
Well, if I first approach esports like any other sports, I mean, the moment the gaming community decide to switch the name to sport, whether e-sport, A-sport, B-sport, but you use the word sports and you want to be treated like a sport, there are certain regulations. For example, issues of doping. Eventually, they have to deal with doping. All professional players all over the world, they play football, basketball, athlete, they're tested. It's no different than esports players. At the moment, I think the doping process have not really come in yet into esports, number one. Number two, the issues of integrity, which can include many, many layers of integrity. One is the players themselves. There's issues of corruption, match fixing, match betting on themselves to lose. There are many instances of that happening. And then when you catch a player, for example, say betting on herself or himself to lose, what are the steps taken to ban the player? Mm. Also not there. So that flows nicely to the issue of the integrity of the association, corruption in selection of president, selection of bidding host nation, so like the upcoming international by Dota 2. So how did they choose that host? Was there any corruption? As you know, in FIFA and IOC, there are strict rules in choosing select the bidding host. The third issues of integrity would include, for purposes of esports, the manipulation of the game, because esports is a software. And so if I corrupt the software by putting in a virus, would that affect the integrity of the game? Still not addressed. So there's just two. One is doping. Two is integrity. The third one are the rules and regulation of tournament. Every tournament is different. We have differing rules, differing interpretation. It's very confusing. Same tournament held in KL and Ipoh have two different rules. That has to be addressed. Mm. Fourth is, I would say, the issues of media. In most of the major sports, the rules governing media, what you can and cannot broadcast. So esports have that problem because anybody can stream the game live. And esports effectively doesn't need television at all. So we will not get, we're very unlikely to get similar deals that we see for the Premier League and the Olympics worth billions of dollars to showcase on television. Because in esports, they don't need it. That community use the internet to stream. So how do you deal with that? Because they are streamers, and then they are streamers of streamers, and then they are people who steal someone streaming and stream on their stream. So how do you deal with that?
Such a big web of...
Big problem, yeah.
I'm just curious, what does e-doping look like?
You're good at this. Why don't you do this?
E-doping is basically something you do to give you an advantage in the game. So there are two ways these things can happen. Actually, three. One is you actually modify the software itself. The other one is manipulation of the hardware itself, the keyboard, the mouse, where one click of a button actually does three things or five things at the same time, instantaneously. Of course, the third way of e-doping is where there is not much modification, but because, as Richard said earlier, everything is broadcasted on the internet, including the tournament itself. So I can actually be playing a tournament, competing in a tournament, yet watching that tournament being broadcast. So that gives me an aerial eagle eye view of what's happening, and I can you know, make my strategy in line with whatever information that I'm having.
We are discussing esports and the upcoming esports tournament, the International. I'm speaking to Richard Wee, who's a sports lawyer, and Brian Wu, a paralegal. We will be right back after the short break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. I'm speaking to Richard Wee, sports lawyer, and Brian Wu, a paralegal, and we are discussing esports and the upcoming esports tournament, the International. So before the break, we had a brief overview of what qualifies as e-sport, as well as some of the common legal issues facing this industry. But now we're going to take a look at the International. You know, it's one of the most anticipated e-sports events of the year, and that's happening this month. Right. So could you briefly give us an overview of this event and, you know, what it's about?
So the premise of this game, the premise of this tournament is Dota 2. Mm. It has garnered a lot of attraction worldwide, because people have been playing it since Dota 1 days before it became Dota 2. And so if I could draw an analogy from, let's say, football, the International is like the World Cup of Dota 2 tournaments.
I see.
So winning the International, you get to flaunt that you are the best team in the world. Of course, prize money is huge. Mm. I think as it stands, the International 19... is the champion will get about 14 million as it stands now for the whole team. So it's a lot of money and a lot of glory at stake.
And how do teams qualify for this?
The publishers for Dota 2, Valve, recently, or past two to three years, came with a new qualifying system in which they have a number of smaller tournaments throughout the year, which gives you points if you win them. So the top 12 points accumulated, top teams with the top 12 points would immediately qualify for the International. At the same time, there's another 6 slots which are open to regional qualifiers, which means anybody in the world can take part in that qualifiers and possibly make it to the International.
Hmm. So Richard, of the legal issues that you mentioned earlier, how many of those do you actually see being a concern for a tournament like the International?
This World Cup Dota, the International, is one of the better organized. In fact, I would dare say one of the top organized esports tournament. Very well managed. They have proper internal disciplinary rules. I think they have mechanisms to keep an eye on the player. Any opportunity or any chance to manipulate the game is extinguished. So it's a fair play game. Mm. Effectively, as you know, in sports, you want to be treated fairly. You want a fair game to win. So the International is very well run, and it's something which a standard which we can aspire towards. Or for an aspiring tournament organizer, look at what they are doing at the International, learn and apply it to your tournament.
Hmm. And so this season, 3 Dota 2 players made racial statements. One was banned by the publisher from competing in a major tournament. Another was kicked off the team, while the third was only given a warning by the team and had to give up his winnings from a major tournament, as well as give assurance that such a situation will never happen again. So Brian, you know, what are your thoughts on that? It seems like three very different ways of dealing with a similar issue.
This is one area where Richard and I have noticed and we have an issue with, that is the strength or the authority of the governing agency or organization. So if we take FIFA, for example, if FIFA bans a player, he is banned worldwide. Of course, there is a reason. We know why exactly that person is banned. However, in esports, each game has their own publisher, which owns the rights to the game. Therefore, they set the rules. They can allow a player to play or not play, for that matter. So in this situation, we are not sure what exactly is the reason why certain players are banned, certain players are not, certain players are given a lighter sentence, because there isn't really a formal statement like a decision or grounds of decision that is released by the publisher. So a lot of times the community can only guess why the publishers choose to make such a sanction, give such a sanction or punishment. But we feel that that is an area lacking in esports, that the publishers can do something more about the disciplinary part of esports.
So this is, you know, this the major tournament we're talking about, is that also the international in this case?
They were the smaller tournaments that give you the points to qualify for the international.
I see.
Yeah.
So those do not fall under the jurisdiction of the main event itself?
They do. However, a lot of the statements released leaves a lot to be wanted, to be craved for. Because, for example, when the person, when one of the players was banned from the major tournament, all the publishers did was, this player is banned, full stop, sort of kind of thing. So there was not much of an explanation. Even if there was, it was very little. We know the player was banned for concealing, for trying to cover up. However, it does not explain why later on another player got off pretty much scot-free. So it's still that big grey question mark that we're not too familiar, we need to understand.
I see. And, you know, if we look deeper into the Dota 2 professional scene, you know, there seems to be some criticisms about unequal punishment. So years ago, a Russian Dota 2 player, Solo, was found to have been involved in match fixing, and he was given a stern warning by the publishers. And after that, a Dota 2 team made up of Malaysians were also found to be involved in match fixing, but was instead given a lifetime ban from the publishers. So, you know, thereby effectively ending the careers of these players. You know, why the differing punishments? Richard, maybe you'd like to start with this.
I'm laughing because it's very difficult to explain. Yeah, we don't know. And carrying from what Brian said earlier, many times when decisions are made to stop, ban, suspend, fine a player, we have no idea why. And of course, this sounds like a very selective prosecution or persecution that two Asian players or Malaysian players were given a lifetime ban, but the other player was not. So we feel that that the lack of a uniform ruling, uniform well, I would say punishment in a very loose way would be helpful. We need that. And we don't have it in esports. So hence why we have this problem. I virtually cannot answer that question because we don't know why.
To be fair to the publishers, there are some publishers in which their esports actually have a book of rules and regulations. For example, the Overwatch League, there is a rules and regulations that has been issued by the commissioner. And in that, if you breach or you do not follow one of those, you are actually liable for punishment. However, the large majority of other esports do not have such a rule or regulation, and Dota 2 unfortunately falls within that that criteria, that category. And the only thing we could possibly, or the community possibly, guess why this is possible, why this is such a situation, is because the first match fixing that ever happened before there was a stern warning or announcement that, you know, this will not be tolerated. However, the Dota 2 Malaysian team, that match fixing happened after the announcement. So, of course, if you made an announcement that you won't tolerate, the punishments will be more severe. But we will need more rules and regulations by the publishers in their own respective esports.
I mean, I'm just curious, can the players take any form of legal action in response to the kind of punishments or the differing punishments that they have received?
Of course they can. The right is always open to them, but they will face quite a number of legal hurdles. For example, if the... When you come to the realm of law, there are many rules that you have to comply first before you can even think of taking action. So if the tournament, for example, takes place at Amsterdam and the publisher is is based in New York and the player is a Malaysian player who happened to reside in, say, South Africa, So where do you file a suit? So that's the first question. And then, of course, some lawyers may say, oh, we'll file in New York. So it's not easy for a Malaysian to file a suit in New York.
Right.
So there are practical challenges, though legally the player in that kind of situation that we mentioned have that avenue and they can take it up, but it'll probably cost them quite a substantial amount of cost to proceed.
I think to add on to Richard, Richard is right in that there is this whole issue of jurisdiction and cost, but we also shouldn't forget that at the end of the day, one major difference between esports and sports is that sports belong to nobody. No one actually owns the right to football or badminton. But in esports, Dota 2, for example, someone actually owns the game, the right to the game.
Mm.
And so the players are playing it based on a license from the publisher. So when the publisher bans a player, he's effectively saying, I'm revoking my license for you to play. So you don't have the license to use my product. You don't have the license to play the game. Therefore, effectively, you can't play Dota anymore. So it's not just like FIFA where there's a cumulative agreement, whereas this is quite legal in the sense that there is actually a document that you have to agree to in order to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
So the revocation of license is the right of the publisher, something that we have to bear in mind as well.
I see. And over the years, the international has always had, the issue of players getting their visas rejected or not being able to get their visas in time for this tournament. And as a result of that, it would deny the player from competing at it. And, you know, it also affects the team's chances of winning. You know, what are the reasons behind this and what can be done to tackle that issue?
When it comes to visa, athletes usually have a special visa to enter, let's say, the United States.
Mm.
So when it comes to esports, unfortunately, there are many countries that don't see esports at the same level of sports.
Mm.
So when you apply, Dota, the international traditionally has always been held in the US. So when they apply for an athlete's visa or a P visa, they are rejected on grounds that you are not technically an athlete, so you would have to apply for a different kind of visa. But given a short timeline, it's very difficult for them to reapply for another form of visa. So for Valve, at the very least, what they're trying to do to circumvent this issue is to host the tournament in different countries. So last year we had it in Canada, this year we'll be in China. Of course, as Richard mentioned earlier, there's also the issue of was there a bidding process?
Mm.
How does the selection of countries go? And that is another legal issue altogether.
And as you've just said, there is always that issue with how people generally perceive esports, you know, that it's not a quote actual sport. So how do you respond to that criticism? Should esport players be entitled to the same rights as athletes in physical sports?
At the moment, eventually, yes. I think the esports athletes will eventually be acknowledged fairly similarly to the normal athletes and the traditional athletes that we have. But at the moment, it'll take time for people to acknowledge that. I think if you ask, for example, a rugby player or a football player, they'll be quite unhappy that someone who just sits down on a chair and play a game will be considered an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this person who is busting the guts out on the pitch, getting injured, breaking their legs, is also an athlete. So, because most people still equate sports to the sweat, the tears, running on the pitch, or on a badminton court, a squash court. But esports, and therefore, there lies the problem because people really don't understand what esports players do. Yes, of course, at the crux of it, the esports players really just sit down and mentally focus on the game and using their reactive skills, their fingers in the hands, to control the keyboard or the whatever instructive panel and try to compete the other person and win. But behind the scene, this player, actually, for a professional player, would have trained 6 to 12 hours a day. They live in a particular bungalow house or a certain home together. They eat and sleep together so that they work as a team. They understand each other. Dota 2 require 3 or 4 players to play one go. Mm. So A needs to know B, B needs to know C, C needs to know D. And again, many people may not know that esports professional teams have psychologists, some have nutritionists, and they also are required to run. They are required to stay healthy. Right. They need to be fit. They may not have six packs muscle, but they have a six packs brain, for example, to play. So I think mindset needs to change. I don't blame a physical sports player to say, hey, how can this person be a player when I'm the one, you know, bursting my guts out? I don't blame that mentality because they don't know what esports player go through. So eventually, I think more once people begin to more understand what esports players do, what they go through in order to win a game, then yeah, they'll change. Don't forget, we had this same problem with X Games. So 15, 20 years ago, when people were jumping around on a BMX, I remembered some elder people said, that can't be sports. You know, climbing a rock, that can't be sports. But now rock climbing is an Olympic sport.
Right.
So, and no one is complaining. So it'll take time, and I think eventually esports players will be on the same level with normal players. Yeah.
And Brian, you know, what are other general legal issues that you are looking for Valve to address for the upcoming 2019 or 2020 season?
Well, Valve has indirectly expressed that one of the issues they want to tackle in the coming announcement they're going to make at the international is racism in Dota 2. Particularly at the competitive level. There were racial slurs being used in official games. Mm. So that is one issue that we are looking, we're waiting to see how Valve will handle the issue. The other issue is the last year, Valve actually said that they want the teams to stay away from betting sites and sponsorship from betting sites. Of course, this is an issue of integrity because you want the players and the team to be not only to play fair, but to be seen to be paying fair. And so they gave an announcement saying that teams should start staying away. However, a lot of these teams still have contracts with these sponsorship contracts with these betting sites, and Valve has yet to address are they supposed to breach the contract, or how does Valve want these teams to handle these contracts with the betting sites. So these are the two main areas that I'm actually looking at in terms of the legal side of Dota 2.
I suppose we'll just have to wait and see what happens with the reforms that is going to take place within ESM. So more on that hopefully soon. But we have to wrap up the show. Do the two of you have a final message for listeners? Brian?
I think the esports is gaining traction, is growing bigger and bigger. The young people and not so young people right now are getting drawn into playing games and understanding esports a lot more. And I think companies, governments, associations, organizations have also shown an interest in esports. So while it is very encouraging to see the growth of esports and the attention that it gets, I think esports itself needs to quickly get in place certain regulations to regulate itself and, you know, rules and to sort out these main issues before they can actually go be carried to the next level.
Mm.
Yeah, Richard?
Well, I'm looking forward to hear from the ministry on the esports blueprint. See the direction of the government with esports, number one. Number two, I also hope that the ESM or Esports Federation, they will take steps to, I'm confident they will, they take steps to get things better and more effective for the community. And I think in terms of law, esports law, the biggest challenge for this area is to get the concept of rules and regulation uniform, standardized, accepted throughout, not just Malaysia, yeah, but the whole world.
Mm.
It has to be the whole world. You can have a little bit of tweak here and there, you know, yellow card different here, yellow card different there, like for football. But across the world must be the same. And once that happens, the sponsors start coming in. I think the people will invest more comfortably once they know that things are uniform and stable. But until such time, the esports is basically a day by day basis for now. But when we speak to the esports community, I feel that the entire community wants to go towards a proper governance, proper regulation, and it will happen, lah. I'm sure it will eventually.
Well, thank you very much for joining me on the show today, Brian and Richard.
Thank you.
I was speaking to Richard Wee. He's a sports lawyer, and Brian Wu, a paralegal. We were discussing esports and the upcoming esports tournament, the International. If you've missed any part of this interview or any Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.